It's really an honor and a pleasure to be back here at Pardes. It's a privilege to teach here and to teach also in front of my teachers, which is basically not allowed. So I'll ask permission from Rev Landes and from all. And I should say that back in 95, 96, I sat in that room across the hall. Leah was my Talmud teacher. And some of the texts that we are going to look at today, I first encountered with Leah. You always remember your first Gemara teacher. And for me, that was Leah. And it was in this Beit Midrash that I was privileged to do that learning. So it's an honor to be back. What we're going to look at today is the story of the writing of Avinu Malkeinu. And part of what I've been interested in over the years is trying to analyze tefillot, trying to analyze prayers from the perspective of what are the prayers referring to? What texts are they in dialogue with? Usually from the Bible. But what we're going to look at today is a little bit of a different sense of that method, which is to say, how can we understand a prayer differently and better if we understand who wrote it and under what circumstances it was written? So that's our task today, is to try to explore that with Avinu Malkeinu. And we're going to do that basically by focusing on two stories in the Bavli. One is the direct story of the writing of Avinu Malkeinu. One is the story immediately preceding it. And one parallel story in the Yerushalmi, which I think will add to our understanding of the writing. And as we move on through the hour, we'll look at some other stories as well. So it'll be an opportunity to look at some stories in the Talmud as well as look at a tefillah. Just to start off, when I say Avinu Malkeinu, what sort of emotions come to mind? What sort of comes up for you when you think about reciting Avinu Malkeinu? Somber, yeah. Say a little bit more. Okay, great. So awe moment. The tune is I'm gonna guess at which tune you're talking about, but there's certain tunes in Ashkenaz and that call upon that mood. Other, I heard something else. Hungry. Okay, good. Yes. That's going to be relevant for our story here. Any other sort of emotions that rise up for you? Sorry?
Pleading.
Pleading. Yeah, say a word. What are we pleading for? Yeah, okay. You use the word desperate. It's a desperate poem to ask God to forgive us. If you were thinking of the person who was writing this poem and the state that they were in or the character that they embodied, pleading, somber, this sense of this is my last chance, as it were. So what I want to do is pass around the sheet so you can actually take a look a little bit at what we're going to see as the context for the writing here. I think I'm tethered to this. Okay, great. Excellent. And what I'm going to ask you to do is, as the sheets are coming around, I'm going to ask you to turn to a neighbor and to learn in Chavruta the very first text on the page, which is two stories from Masechet Ta'anit. We'll see that the original locus of Avinu Malkeinu, you mentioned hungry. I'm assuming that's because you're fasting related to Yom Kippur. You say it on every fast day. But the moment in which this prayer actually shows up in the Talmud, it's very unusual, actually, for a prayer to show up in the Talmud. Most of the prayers are either referred to in very little snippets or not at all, and we're meant to guess at what the actual prayers that the Tanaim were reciting are. But here we have the writing of this prayer in the Talmud, and it comes in this series of stories from Masechet Ta'anit. Ta'anit deals with the question of how do you end a drought? Okay? And one of the ways in which you end a drought is by declaring a fast, which we're going to see in the first story. And the other way in which you'll end a drought is by saying a particular type of the Amidah. But what I'm going to ask you to do is to read the story, really these two stories in text number one, the top of the first page here, and to ask as many questions as you can about the story. Okay? So turn to your neighbor, read it out loud, just box number one, as many questions as you can come up with. Take 5 minutes. Okay, great. Thank you. Hey, how are you? Good to see you.
Sorry, I'm late.
Welcome. Grab a text and find the Chavruta. We're just learning box number one. Saying hello. Good. How are you guys?
Good.
So glad to be in your baby dress.
Yeah. We were gonna come up to you, but whatever. Didn't want to psych you out before.
Yeah.
Before you're sure calling.
Good. I didn't want to interrupt your learning, but I want to say hello. Okay, let's bring it back here. Even if you're not totally finished, we'll have an opportunity to look at this together. Okay, in the very first story, Tanu Rabbanan, who wants to read it, either in the Hebrew or the English, just the first story. Yeah, please.
A rabbi taught Mishnah a story. point, though. At the end of the fast, people started to meet. He said to them, have you prepared your graves for yourself? And if you will put this here as burying yourself.
Okay, great. Stop there. What jumps out at you from this story? What questions did you have, or what struck you? Yeah.
It's that the fast didn't do anything, but that it was like the raw emotion that poured out from the people that made the rain.
Okay. So you're saying two things. First of all, the fast didn't actually bring the rain, and that's significant because the whole way in which you're supposed to bring the rain is actually by declaring the fast, meaning the proper way of doing this is to declare fast after fast, up to 13 fasts, and that was done, and nothing has happened. And then you said, but what did bring the rain, you said?
Like this burst of raw emotion.
Good. Okay, what's the burst of raw emotion?
That they cry over what it is that he's saying to them.
Okay, all the people burst into tears. That's what you're identifying as the emotion. Yeah, because it could be there was another emotional outburst as well, right? Which seems to be Rabbi Ezer's line beforehand, which we don't exactly know the force of it, but have you prepared graves for yourselves? What's the force of that statement? We'll look at it in a second. But it seems like the people cry, that's what brings the rain. The fast actually doesn't bring the rain. What else jumps out at you from the story? Yeah?
Why is it only after he said this that they begin to cry? It seems as though the situation's already pretty dire if they're fasting 13 times, so why aren't they aware of their own mortality or their own fear until he says?
Good. What is it about the people and their state such that Rabbi Ezer has to be the one who occasions this outburst, this crying, when they're what's their mood when they're the line before, ba'achrona, yidchilu atzibor latzeit, they, at the end, this is also a little ambiguous, at the end of what, not sure, about the last, let's call it, the public began to go out. What was their emotional state there? Were they, about to burst into tears, or were they like, oh, I guess shul's over, let's go home, this isn't working. And what is it about his statement, his three words, that turns them around and has them burst out into tears? What do you think about Rabbi Ezer's statement there? What is he trying to accomplish in that moment?
Seems like a reality check of like, you're going to give up now, so you're giving up, you're going to die. If you give up now, you lost everything.
Uh-huh.
And that moment, like, oh, wait, we should do something. And that's where the tears came from, that he realized their actions were so important and could actually change everything.
Do you think he expected them to react in that way?
I think he did very much so. I think this sounds like classic Jewish guilt. Like, all right, well, you guys don't want to pass somewhere, that's fine. You guys
are, we're not going to have minion tomorrow, all right? See you tomorrow, right? Okay, yeah, so you're saying that either he is saying, what you said, a reality check. Rabbi Eliezer is nothing if not real. He's telling the situation as it is, and this is, you're actually going to die. I'm just reporting to you what's going to happen. Or you're saying, no, he's actually, with the end in mind, trying to get some rise out of the people, and whereas the fast didn't work, this little statement seemed to have worked, and they, as a result, burst out into tears. Yeah.
When we read Lasset, does that necessarily mean that they were leaving, like, the physical place? Because, like, if everything was, they were done, they were supposed to leave, but he seems to be kind of telling them off because they leave, like,
good. Is there something that is the dynamic between Rabbi Eliezer and the people, one in which Rabbi Eliezer somehow is offended? In other words, he's trying to orchestrate this 13th fast, and all their contribution up till this point is to leave. Right? They're leaving the moment, the scene, whatever it is, and maybe he's actually saying something in anger or negative towards them, not only just a sort of facts only, FYI, you're going to die. It's also important to note, where is he in all this? He says, have you prepared your graves for yourselves? Right? He's not there. Have we prepared our graves? He's not including himself in there. So there may be, he's certainly on one side, and they seem to be on the other, and they're the object of his, in your language, his rebuke, if I'm hearing you correctly. Okay. Let's look at the next story, okay? Shuv Maaseh, right? Another story. And here, who wants to read it? We again have Rabbi Eliezer, but we have a new character as well. Go ahead.
Another story. Rabbi Eliezer led the Amidah, literally went down the and said 24 blessings, including 6 additional blessings.
Yeah, good. So just to pause, this is a technical point. The standard Amida, the weekday Amida, has how many blessings? Trick question. Okay, yeah, it's tough. Right, but in Eretz Yisrael, they had 18 blessings. We now say 19 blessings. Very confusing. Anyways, it's called Shemona Esrei, but we say Cha Esrei. The standard weekday Amida had 18 blessings. And he adds an additional 6, which the Mishnah in Ta'anit goes on to describe what the liturgy is for those 6 blessings. So again, Mishnah Ta'anit is plan A, do fasts. Plan B, add these 6 brachot to your Amida, which they're going to lay out for you, and that will bring the rain. So again, Rabbi Eliezer is following the rules here, and he does the Amida that's supposed to happen, but he's not answered. Okay, presumably meaning the rain doesn't come. Go ahead.
Rabbi Akiva led after him and said, "Our Father, our King, we have sinned before you. Our Father, our King, we have no king but you. Our Father, our King, for your sake have mercy on us." And the rain fell. The rabbis shouted and complained. A heavenly voice came out and said, "Not that this one is greater than that one. Rather, this one passes over his midot, character aspects, and this one does not pass over his midot."
Okay, let's hold off on the end Bat Kol's moment section for a moment. Let's just look at what Rabbi Akiva does. Rabbi Akiva gets up and says, after Rabbi Eliezer has his failed Amida, Rabbi Akiva gets up and says, "Avinu Malkeinu," and now here I'm going to read the most minimal version of this. That is to say, the version that's preserved in most of the manuscript. "Avinu Malkeinu, ein lanu melach ela ata. Avinu Malkeinu, rachem aleinu." That's the entire Avinu Malkeinu. Okay? Now we know Avinu Malkeinu from our prayer as, right? Avinu Malkeinu, Avinu Malkeinu. It's extremely long, and as is the way with Jewish liturgy, it gets longer over time. But the original Avinu Malkeinu, as sort of at a minimum, has 2 Avinu Malkeinus, so it's still a repetition, but nevertheless not in the way that we experience it today. Whereas in some of the manuscripts it's 3, the sort of minimal one is 2. So how do you just taking that piece of liturgy for a second? Avinu Malkeinu ein lanu melech ela ata. Avinu Malkeinu rachem aleinu. We have no king but you. Have mercy on us. What do you make of that? Why does that work? Why is that better than the 18 blessings plus the 6 blessings? Yeah.
Because boil down the situation to their absolute contingency. That there's no pomp and circumstance other than the fact that they're absolutely dependent. And their dependence means that they have to receive rachamim or they're hopeless. It's just the bare bones pivot between being dependent and being given grace.
Yeah, if you had to strip down liturgy to its basic components, right, there's an address, Avinu Malkeinu, and then there is a sort of, as you're saying, an admission or acknowledgement. We have no king but you. Avinu Malkeinu ein lanu melech ela ata. So sort of A, B, Malkeinu, B, melech. And then Avinu Malkeinu rachem aleinu. What does rachem call up? What aspect does it call up? Mercy, compassion. But what's it mean literally? Womb, right? The parent. Now again, we translate Avinu as father, but you sort of have the parent side. Avinu Malkeinu ein lanu melech ela ata, rachem aleinu. You sort of have this A, B, B, A, and we want the rachamim. That's what we're going for here. Interestingly, again, you know, in our version of Avinu Malkeinu and in some versions of the Gemara, it says chatanu lefanecha.
The Gemara doesn't have it.
Yeah.
The Gemara says it's usher.
It's usher. Yeah, it goes that far. Why?
You have the Gemara, you're the teacher. It's not about our faith, it's about our dependence.
Good, right? This whole idea, we start off Avinu Malkeinu as chatanu lefanecha, we're going to acknowledge our sin before you. But actually, Rabbi Akiva isn't talking about sin at all. He's simply talking about the relationship. We have this dual aspect relationship. There's the melech relationship, you are our king. And there's the parent relationship, you should have mercy on us. And that's what we're calling upon, sort of regardless of our own behavior. Okay? That's the Avinu Malkeinu of Rabbi Akiva. Yeah.
This seems to have a sort of parallel to the first story in that it's this, instead of the sort of prescribed, stated, stately, whatever, 6 extra brachas, it's this outcry. Right, it's a sort of just a very primal scream that's been preserved through the generations, but it has the same sense of like, you know, the emotion.
Good. Just to remind us, when Rabbi Akiva got up to the Amud, or really down to the Amud, He didn't say, okay, everybody turn to page 493 for Avinu Malkeinu. This is a spontaneous outburst of Rabbi Akiva, much in the way you're pointing out that the crying is a spontaneous outburst by the people. And interestingly enough, now you're sort of taking your comment about whether Rabbi Eliezer did it on purpose in the first story or not, if you see this as the proximate cause to the rain, is actually in neither story Rabbi Eliezer. Right? Rabbi Eliezer is doing what he's supposed to be doing, and the emotional outburst is actually coming from a different quarter. In the first story, it's the people, and in the second story, it's Rabbi Akiva. And that's the Avinu Malkeinu. And by the way, when do we say Avinu Malkeinu on fast days or on Yamim Noraim? After the Amidah. And is the Amidah long? Yes, it's very long, right? So we have this very, very long Amidah. That's sort of our experience on High Holidays. We say this extremely long Amidah. You know, I think my general rule of thumb is the people who are reading the words in davening, they're the ones who finish last on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Everybody else is long seated. But there's so many words to get through. If you're actually making your way through the words, it just takes a very, very long time. And then immediately following, or basically immediately following, Avinu Malkeinu, that's the sort of, we're done with the Amidah, now we're on to Plan B. Okay? That's the Rabbi Akiva moment of High Holidays, is we went through the prescribed Amidah. It presumably isn't working. Let's pull out the stops and try Avinu Malkeinu. Now, ironically, it's not spontaneous liturgy, right? It is page 493 or whatever it is, right? You're reading it out. But that's the original force of it. It's not a standard liturgical move that is supposed to bring the mercy. Yeah.
I think there's also a huge change in the language with a communal aspect. And at least like when I dive in the Amidah, it's a very personal experience. And it seems like when Rabbi Eliezer is doing it, and in the first story, he's really doing it as an individual. When Rabbi Akiva is speaking, he's speaking on behalf of the community. And that shows a very powerful leader that's willing to say not just I have sinned, but also to sort of acknowledge the community sins and take the responsibility as a prayer leader. And I think the very language that it doesn't say Avi or Malchi, it says Avinu, completely changes the dimension.
Yeah, so you're pointing to something very interesting, which is to the extent that the move of the prayer leader is reflective of their own sense of their standing in the community, maybe something is at play here beyond the words, or you're saying the words point to some understanding of how they see themselves vis-a-vis the community. I should just point out that the Amidah itself is also said in the plural, like Eloheinu Ve'Elohei Avoteinu. So if, again, we don't exactly know what the words of the Amidah are that Rabbi Eliezer was saying, but if you assume that it was based on the liturgy that we are saying today, the plural might not be the issue, but the stance or the relationship that they have to the community might be very much an issue. And that's what I want to explore with you a little bit. We have we're going to go in two directions. The first is, let's just talk about the feelings here for a second. The feelings, you're Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Akiva just finished saying Avinu Malkeinu and the rain came. How are you feeling? I'm assuming you are feeling something. What's that?
Slighted.
You're feeling slighted, yeah?
Confused.
Confused, yeah?
My brothers aren't good enough?
Yeah, right? Hey, I'm following the rules, right? And this guy says spontaneous liturgy and he's answered, right? This, I think, is a little bit of what's trying to be dealt with at the end of the story. Havu Miranane Rabbanan. This is also an ambiguous statement here. They were either shouting or complaining. Something was going on, such that a bat kol came out and said, it's not that this one is greater than that one. Who's the this and the that? It's not that Rabbi Akiva is greater than Rabbi Eliezer, but rather, this one is ma'avir al midotav, and this one is not ma'avir al midotav. Now, we don't know what that means just yet, but ma'avir al midotav is who? Who's the one who's ma'avir al midotav? Rabbi Akiva, right? Okay? Not that he's gadol, but he's ma'avir al midotav, and Rabbi Eliezer is... not that he's not gadol, but he's just not ma'avir al midotav. Okay, this is the reason why Rabbi Akiva is answered. So the bat kol, I think, is a little bit trying to do something to tell you that don't assume that Rabbi Akiva is greater than Rabbi Eliezer. It's just that they have this different approach to midot. Okay, which we're going to explore in a little bit. I want to, before we, by the way, one last just sort of fact to note. What's the relationship between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva? Right. Rabbi Akiva is the student of Rabbi Eliezer. Okay, so it's not just that he is not greater, but he gets the job done, and Rabbi Eliezer does not get the job done. But this, just imagine the drama. The student gets up and essentially shows up the teacher. Okay? That's the scene that just happened. Okay? Now we're going to look at one other related story in the Yerushalmi, and then we're going to explore the relationship between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer very briefly. Okay? The story in the Yerushalmi, I'm on the bottom of the page one. Rabbi Eliezer made a fast, but no rain fell. Rabbi Akiva made a fast, and the rain fell. Okay, so you can see this is clearly a parallel story or scenario. Rabbi Akiva entered and said before them, he says, I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to tell you a parable. Em sholachem mashal. This is a parable. Lema davar domeh. What is this similar to? Lemelech shehayu lo shtei banot. It's like a king who had two daughters. Achat chatzufa v'achat kshera. One of them was brazen, was chutzpedik, right? And one of them was kosher, was fitting, was proper. When the brazen one wanted to enter before him, before the king, he said, give her what she wants so that she may go away. Right? Just give her something and she'll get out of here. But when the proper one wanted to enter before him, he was patient because he liked hearing her pleas. Okay? Now, who's the chatzufa and who's the kshera in this story that Rabbi Akiva is telling on the spot? Who's the chatzufa? Rabbi Akiva. Okay? And Rabbi Eliezer is the kshera. So Rabbi Akiva essentially says, the reason why my fast was answered is because God doesn't want to listen to me. Right? The one who God rejects, that's the one who God answers. Okay? That's who gets the rain. Whereas the one who God loves, God will not answer. Why? God just wants to hear more and more of that crying, of those pleas. Okay, now, again, the story starts off with declaring a fast, but you can see here, at least in the mashal, there is some communication that's involved. It's not simply not eating, but it's also these cries out. So I want to sort of read the stories in light of each other. Okay, in light of each other, Rabbi Akiva is the one who is chatzufa, and therefore Avinu Malkeinu is a chutzpedik prayer. And it is a chutzpedik prayer. It's not in the Mishnah. It's not what you're supposed to say. The Amida that Rabbi Eliezer does is the kshera. That is the kosher thing to do. Right? So Rabbi Akiva is then sort of reading this backwards and saying, ah, you think I'm greater? You think I'm better? Turns out, he's better. Why? He wasn't answered. God doesn't answer the prayers, the fasts, of the one that God loves. Yeah. Read the end of the story. Is it permissible to say this?
Rather, it was to prevent
blasphemy and happening. Okay, now, when the Gemara asks, when the Gemara asks, is it permissible to say this? What is upsetting about that story that Rabbi Akiva tells that the Gemara says, but can one really even say this? Seems to be a lie. Why?
Because you would think it would be the opposite.
God answers the ones that God loves. Not God answers the one who God doesn't love. Right? Yeah?
It also means that there might be a danger that people would always do it in a chutzpedik way if they knew they would be answered. There would be no such thing as kosher prayer anymore.
Ah, okay. We're all becoming chutzpedik daveners here, and that's the only way we get the job done. Yes, okay, God doesn't love me, but at least we're getting some rain. Right? But theologically also, you want to walk around with a religion in which, listen, I'm going to tell you how you know God loves you. God loves you when all of your deepest prayers are ignored. And the reason that God loves you is because God actually likes listening to your crying more than God wants to answer you. Right? Now, just think about, on the face of it, the difficulty of that theology, which you could take at face value, but at least the Gemara seems to be objecting to something in the story here. The difficulty of that theology is also to demonstrate how far Rabbi Akiva is willing to go in order to protect the honor of the house of Rabbi Eliezer. Yeah.
Can this
Akiva, Mavir al-Midotav. He's like, he's basically saying that he's not so good, and also in respect of Rabbi Eliezer. So he's maybe the reason why the Avinu Malkan also was answered.
Good. Okay, so you're trying to relate the... All we know in the Bavli story about Rabbi Akiva and why he was answered is that he is Ma'avir al-Midotav, whatever that means. And what you're trying to say is the Rishami might be an example of what Ma'avir al-Midotav behavior would look like, right? Passing over your character traits. Whatever that behavior looks like, maybe that's what's playing out here. And I want to hold that because I think you're on to something. Now, just to notice again, when you compare the two stories, in both of the stories... Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer's honor is being defended. In the second story, in the Yerushalmi, it's being defended by Rabbi Akiva. In the first story, who's it being defended by again? God, a bat kol. Right? A heavenly voice is coming out and saying, don't think that this one's greater than that one. Rather, this one is Ma'avir al-Midotav or not. Now, that's actually, I would say the Yerushalmi story is even going to greater lengths at defending Rabbi Eliezer because it's saying, The one who comes out in the losing column in the Yerushalmi is essentially God, right? In order for Eliezer's honor to be saved, God has to love the people who God doesn't answer, right? In the Bavli, the Bat Kol says, no, it's not that Rabbi Akiva is greater than Rabbi Eliezer, but rather there is a difference between them. It's just that this one is Ma'avir al-Midotav and this one isn't. And I'm purposely not going into Ma'avir al-Midotav, but we'll look at what that means towards the end. But so sort of, I want to just take it back to our experience of Avinu Malkeinu here for a moment, which is to say, when you get up and say Avinu Malkeinu, according to the Yerushalmi, again, reading the stories together, you are embodying a chutzpahdik daughter, a chutzpahdik princess, right? A bat melech chatzufa. She is the one who gets up and says Avinu Malkeinu. So next time you look at your prayer leader on high holidays, you sort of imagine what's going on in that moment. It's the daughter of the king. So when you say Avinu Malkeinu, we often think of them as sort of like a binary. You're either our parent, father, or our king. But this is actually whose parent is a king? A princess or prince, right? So we are, first of all, the children of the king. And second of all, it's the daughter. And third of all, it's the chatzufa, right? It's a chutzpahdik prayer. That's what you're doing in the moment of Avinu Malkeinu. You're embodying that, at least the way Rabbi Akiva self-understands. Okay? But sort of taking this, widening the lens and the angle here of who the people are, who the characters are in this story, why is Rabbi Akiva going to such lengths to defend the honor of Rabbi Eliezer? Or I'll put it stronger, which is to say, what does Rabbi Akiva do in order to defend the honor of Rabbi Eliezer? He puts himself down and God, and is it true? Not true, right? He's telling a lie, okay? He's essentially inventing a story that probably is not related to the truth, at least as the Gemara understands it, in order to save the honor of Rabbi Eliezer. This is a very, very important thing that Rabbi Akiva sees himself doing such that he sort of abrogates a norm, which is to say, tell the truth. Now, why would he be doing this? We already said that Rabbi Akiva is the student of Rabbi Eliezer. What do we know about their relationship? Or I'll put it to you another way. Do you remember a story? If you know any stories, you might know this story. Do you remember another story, actually the only other story, where a bat kol comes out and defends Rabbi Eliezer's honor? Tanur Shel Achnai, right? Tanur Shel Achnai, which is the story in which, in brief, did you already learn here? Yeah? Hands up? Who's read it? Okay, good. So for the minority who hasn't seen it yet, in brief, what's the brief story? Set the scene. What's the brief story of Tanur Shel Achnai? Good. Thank you. Yeah, right? This is the famous statement of, even though a heavenly voice comes down, lo bashamayimi, it's not in heaven, right? Acharei rabim la'atod, you follow the majority. And therefore, who does halakha follow? Not Rabbi Eliezer. Okay? By the way, what kind of tree was it that was uprooted? Yeah, why a carob tree? You ever think about it? What's so awesome about a carob? Why? In all these Talmudic stories, the details are so thin that whenever they tell you something, sort of hold on to it a little bit. How do you say carob in Hebrew? Haruv. What is that? What does that mean? Destruction, right? Cherub is a sword. Churban, right? The destruction. We'll see how that word comes back in the story. So that's how the story usually ends. But there's a second half of the story, right? Do you remember what happens after the majority wins and Rabbi Eliezer is defeated and, you know, all people who believe in liberal democracies are happy, right? What happens afterwards? They take all of Rabbi Eliezer's things that he made tahor and they burn them. And then they excommunicated him. Okay? And then, after they excommunicated him, they had to go and tell him that they excommunicated him because he wasn't even there. In other words, they didn't do it in front of his face. Okay? Now, let's pick up on the story there. I'm on page 2, the second box. Here I bring you the Munich manuscript. You'll see because it's not just a play with manuscripts, but it actually has an interesting, important thing that's related to our issue, which is Avinu Malkeinu. Okay? So I'm 3 lines after the first ellipsis. Botasha ahiviu kol ha-taorot she-tiyeh Rabbi Eliezer v'sarfum ba'esh v'nimnu u-barchuhu. They burned everything that he made tahor. They took a vote and they barchuhu. They blessed him. But when you get blessed, you're actually getting cursed. It's like birkat aminim. The blessing for the heretics, it's a curse. Okay? So they cursed him, that is to say they excommunicated him. Amru, they said, mi elech v'yodio. Who's going to go tell him? Amar lahen Rabbi Akiva, ani elech v'odio. I'm going to go tell him. Shema yelech adam she'no agun v'odio, lest another person go who's not fitting, hagun k'shera, and tell him. V'yachriv et ha'olam. Right, the charuv. Lest someone else go and he will destroy the entire world. Okay? Me'asa, what did Rabbi Akiva do? Lavash shchorin, v'nikaseh shchorin, he wears black, he covers himself in black. Chalatz mina alav, he takes off his shoes. V'alach v'yashav lo b'rachok arba amod. And he stands before Rabbi Eliezer, a distance of arba amod, which is the universal distance that you stand before somebody who is excommunicated. Okay, so if someone's doing that to you, just watch out. Now listen, v'zalgu einav d'ma'ot. What happens? Zalgu einav d'ma'ot. His eyes start flowing with tears. Amarle Akiva, mayom yomim. What's so special about today? Amarle kimdome li shechaverim bidalim mimcha. It seems to me like your friends have been separating from you. Afhu zalgu einav d'maot. Even Rabbi Eliezer, then he too starts to cry. Okay, so just looking at this interaction for a moment here, Rabbi Akiva is the one who cries. They have an exchange. And Rabbi Eliezer responds by crying. Okay? Now what does this remind you of in our stories? Where does a similar thing happen? Good. They cry. Right? Ga'u ha'am bebichia. They burst into tears. And what happens as a result? Shamayim burst into tears, as it were. Right? There is some parallel play that's going on here. The action causes a reaction. Rabbi Akiva's action of crying causes a reaction in Rabbi Eliezer. But what's Rabbi Eliezer's actual relationship to water? Or that is to say, in what way are his eyes actually not used to crying, but something else? Let's just read on for a second. He removed his shoes, sank, and sat on the ground. The world was struck with blight, a third of the wheat crop, a third of the olive crop, and a third of the barley crop. Some say even the dough in the hand of the woman went bad. It was taught, Tana, it was so great on that day, gadol, lo shezeh gadol mizeh. It was so great on that day that every place that Rabbi Eliezer directed his eyes would burn. What does Rabbi Eliezer have coming out of his eyes? Fire, right? He is the embodiment of the anti-water guy. We know that also from another place. What's the who was Rabbi Eliezer's teacher? Yochanan ben Zakkai, right? Yochanan ben Zakkai has five students, and he describes each of them. How does he describe Rabbi Eliezer? What is it? Ah, that's Rabbi Azar ben Arach, right? Ma'ayan amikaber. Yeah, bor seed, she'eino me'abed tipa. He is a plastered cistern that never loses a drop. Now, what does that usually mean, or we understand it to mean? If you never lose a drop, this is a praise. What is it? You have a great memory. Rabbi Eliezer never forgets anything, right? But in this context, in the water context, Rabbi Eliezer is somebody who never loses a drop. He is a sealed container. Nothing ever flows from him, right? Only after Rabbi Akiva cries does he cry, but his normal stance is not letting water flow, but actually letting fire come out. Now, I'm saying this only because part of the thing that you have to check when you're putting someone up at the Amud, or down at the Amud in those days, is what are their character traits? What are they known for? The guy who you want davening for you on the day in which you want rain to come is not the guy who retains water and shoots fire out of his eyes, right? Now again, we don't know which order this is happening in, but we want the guy who is Rabbi Akiva. Why? He's the one who cries. Zalgu'e nav d'ma'ot. Right? He's the one who cries, but he doesn't just cry stam. He cries when he's establishing a relationship with somebody who is on the other side. Right? Rabbi Eliezer is excommunicated. He's distant. And Rabbi Akiva is the one who is the only one who can go and encounter him, lest the whole world be destroyed. And as it was, a third of each of the crops got destroyed anyways. You don't want somebody davening for you to stop the drought who is, when he gets angry, he destroys a third of the wheat, barley, and other crops, right? The olive crop, okay? So this is what I'm trying to say to you, is that the person who leads the davening actually matters. And the person of Rabbi Akiva matters greatly. That is to say, it's not just that the liturgy matters. It's not just that Avinu Malkinu cuts to the point and the 24 blessing Amidah is too long and who can pay attention and it was prescribed and anyways we like abrogating the rules. No, it's the person who's doing it. That's part of what matters, right? Maybe that's the entirety of what matters. Now remember, Rabbi Akiva has this relationship with Rabbi Eliezer. There's one other example of this relationship that plays out, which a teacher of mine, Devorah Steinmetz, has an amazing article about the relationship between this story and the story of Tanur Shelach Nai. So if you haven't read this story in full, you must. Turn over to page 3. We're not going to read it in full. We're just going to read the relevant part for us. This is the end of Rabbi Eliezer's life. At the end of Rabbi Eliezer's life, he is on his deathbed, and he has a number of visitors. Vatanya, it's taught in a braita, Keshechala Rabbi Eliezer, when he got sick, Nichnisu Rabbi Akiva v'chaverav lebakro. Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues go to visit Rabbi Eliezer. Now listen, this is so poignant, it's painful to read. When the sages saw that he was calm, Nichnisu v'yashvu lefanav merachok arba amot. They sit before him at a distance of arba amot. So what's his status? On his deathbed, still excommunicated. Right? Now listen to the dialogue. Amar lahem, lama batem? Why'd you come? They said to him, Lumod Torah banu. We came to learn a little bit of Torah. Amar lahem, barach shav, lama lo batem? Why haven't you come until now? Amar lahem, lo yalanu pnai. We were busy. We got caught up, other things, shopping, right? Amar lahem, now again, this is reality check from Rabbi Eliezer. Amar lahem, tamiani im yamutu mitat atzman. I will be surprised if you all die a regular death. Amar lo Rabbi Akiva, sheli mahu. What about me? What's my fate? Amar lo, shelcha kashem mishelahen. You're going to have the hardest death of all. Now, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. Rabbi Akiva's flesh is sold in the market. Right? He's skinned. But Rabbi Eliezer is, what if you were to describe a trait that Rabbi Eliezer holds, what's the trait? He's harif. But is he Harif with what? He's not wrong. Emet. Sometimes emet can be very, very harsh. This guy embodies emet. How do we know? Halacha kamoto. In all cases. The Bat Kol says, this guy is always correct. And who's the one who tells the story of the two daughters? Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is the one who is willing to not tell the truth, right? In order to get some honor restored. Rabbi Eliezer, his dear student, Rabbi Akiva, comes to visit him on his deathbed, and he's saying, you're going to have the harshest death of them all. Because he's right. He's not wrong, but he doesn't paper it over. Okay? Now, they ask him a series of halachic questions, and then they ask him this last question. The shoe that's on the last, what's the law? He says to them, tahor. He says, it's pure. V'yatza nishmato bitara. And his neshama exits, right? Exits the world, let's say it. Yatza nishmato bitara. By saying the word, when he says the word tahor, that's when he dies. Amad Rabbi Yeshua al Raglav, Rabbi Yeshua, who hasn't been in the scene until now, stands up on his feet. When was the last time he stood up on his feet? Vis-a-vis Rabbi Eliezer. Stood up on his feet to keep the walls from falling down, right? Amad Rabbi Yeshua al Raglav, Ve'amar Hutara Neder, Hutara Neder. The vow is released. The ban is lifted. Now, listen to the coda. L'motza'ei Shabbat. This happens on Erev Shabbat. L'motza'ei Shabbat, after Shabbat, Pagabo Rabbi Akiva, min Kesari Lelod, he's going to Lod, which is where Rabbi Ezra's Beit Midrash was, and Rabbi Yeshua runs into him. Rabbi Akiva was, Hayamakebiv Saro, Ad Shedamo Shotet La'aretz. He was beating his chest so much, till his blood flowed to the ground, right? Rabbi Akiva is the one who flows. He's the one who cries, he brings the rain, he flows with words, Avinu Malkenu, and his blood flows. Patach alav bishura, he opened up, he said this quote, this line, maybe shira, v'amar, avi avi, rochev Yisrael farashav. My father, Israel's chariots and horsemen. Now he's quoting from 2 Kings, chapter 2. Who is the, what's the chariot associated with in 2 Kings? Sorry? Eliyahu. That's the end of that. Eliyahu, yes. And who is the person who's speaking to him? Elisha. Elisha, his student, watches Eliyahu rise up in this chariot of fire. And as he's going up, right? As he's going up to heaven, Elisha says, Avi, Avi. Now here, Rabbi Akiva is saying, Avi, Avi. Avinu Malkenu, Avinu Malkenu. Right? He is, first of all, I want to sort of suggest that sometimes, when we talk to God, when we call God Avinu, we also confuse the father figure or the parent figure that we have in our head. Right? Avi, Avi, Avinu, Avinu. In what way, I sort of put it as a question, in what way, when we daven, are we also speaking to our parents? Right? Now here, Rabbi Akiva, this is not his parent, but this is his spiritual father. Right? In what way are these related? And I should say, in what way does Rabbi Ezra actually resemble God in certain of his actions? Emet, right? Harsh. Not that God is all harsh, but that is an aspect of God, right? You read the Bible, there's some harshness there, right? Okay? And Rabbi Ezra is always correct. Heaven's self defends Rabbi Ezra, right? So in what way is Rabbi Akiva actually playing out the go-between, the mediator between everybody else, all the rabbis, and Rabbi Eliezer, which is parallel to everybody else, Kol Ha'am, the Tzibor, and God. Rabbi Akiva is a go-between. He's the guy you want davening for you because he is a mediator. Right? Whereas, who is Rabbi Eliezer compared to in this quote, Avi Avi, referring to Elijah? What's Elijah known for? What kind of guy is he?
Loner.
He's a loner, right? He's not necessarily a changing guy, right? And that whole thing with the Kol Dimama Daka after the storm and the light show, right? He says the exact same thing. Elijah is also truth, right? He's standing up to the 300 prophets of Baal. This is a fitting comparison for Rabbi Eliezer, right? But he may not be the guy you put up at the Amud when you want the Rachamim side of God to appear. Okay? Now, the last thing I want to explore with you in our last couple of minutes is Ma'avir al Midotav. What does Ma'avir al Midotav mean? When I say midot, if you're doing like sort of a Musar, I don't know, project, your midot, what are your midot? I don't know, showing up on time, right? Not getting angry, not snoozing, whatever it is, right? The midot are usually things that you're working on, okay? What are God's midot? God has 13 of them, right? What are they? Say it out. Rav Chesed Be'emet, okay? Rachum, I like it. Chanun, I like it. Grace. Erech Apayim, patient. Chesed, I like it. Emet, I don't know if I like it. Depends, right? Depends what side of truth I'm on. Okay? Now, Rabbi Ezra certainly has a lot of Emet. Rabbi Akiva is referring to and appealing to God's Rachamim. So what does it mean for God to embody all of these midot? Let's look how God understands this, God's self. Okay? This is on page 4, text number 9. Another amazing, famous story, which is the story of God's prayer. We know that God prays. How do we know God prays? Because his house is called Ki Beiti Beit Tfilah Ikare. My house will be called a house of prayer. That means that God must go to shul. So then the Gemara asks, what does God pray? Right? God doesn't talk in the back. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rabbi Yossi, I'm in number 9. What does God pray? Minayin Shehakadosh Baruch Hu mitpalel. Okay, we did that. How do we know he prays? Tfilatam lo ne'amar ela tfilati. Minayin Shehakadosh Baruch Hu mitpalel. My matzle, what does he pray? What's his amida? Amar Rav Zutra Bar Tuvia Amar Rav, Yehi Ratzon Milfanai, may it be my will, Sheikh Beshu Rachamai at Kasai, that my Rachamim conquers my anger, V'yagolu Rachamai al Midotai, that my Rachamim will over, beat out my Midot. Ve'et Nahegim Banai B'Midat Rachamim, right? But I actually behave with my children through the attribute of Rachamim. What's the fundamental battle that God is struggling with here between Rachamim and Kas or Midot? Midotai, right? That is to say, Midot seems to be a euphemism for the negative Midot, the anti-Rachamim Midot, which Emet can sometimes play, right? So, Ze Ma'avir al Midotav, Ze Eino Ma'avir al Midotav. What is Ma'avir al Midotav? It's Ma'avir al Midot, the opposite of Rachamim. In other words, Rabbi Akiva is the one who embodies the person who is able to overcome his anger, to overcome Emet, and go with Rachamim. V'zei no ma'avir al midotav. And that's not a knock on Rabbi Eliezer, it's just stating who he is. He is a truth guy, he's an Emet guy. But that also comes with a measure of kas. You see in other stories of Rabbi Eliezer, he is a harsh guy. When he calls out Rabbi Akiva and says, you're going to die the worst of them, it's not the first time he predicts deaths of his students. He said, I'd be surprised this guy lives out the week. And he's right. Okay? He's a harsh guy. He says, have you prepared your graves for yourselves? That could be sort of brilliant forethought, or could be just his harsh expression of his anger. Why'd you leave? Why'd you walk out on me? Right? My kavod is at stake. Now, interestingly, Rabbi Mishnah Avot has a statement that is attributed to Rabbi Eliezer about kavod. I have a friend whose theory about Mishnah Avot is that all the statements of the rabbis in Avot are actually a microcosm of their biography. Right? You can sum up a person's life by the statement that they say. What's Rabbi Ezra's statement about kavod? Yi kavod chavercha, chaviv alecha kishelcha. May the honor of your friend be as dear to you as your own honor. Rabbi Ezra, his honor is constantly being trampled by his friends. Chaverim kimdome, shechaverim bedelim mimcha. Seems like your friends, your colleagues, are separating from you. They push him out, right? And all he wants is kavod. The story of Avinu Malkeinu is one in which Rabbi Eliezer's kavod is under threat. And even though Rabbi Akiva has to stand up and get the job done, even though Acharim Rabim Lahatot, Rabbi Eliezer is left by the side of the road, right? He is cast aside again because he's not the one who's going to bring the rain. He's not the one who's going to be followed for the way of, you know, Jewish jurisprudence. But at the end of the day, he also represents
this truth element that God has as well. And God's prayer, as identified here, God's prayer is to say, I hope my truth, I hope my anger doesn't beat out my mercy. So what I'm trying to sort of develop here is the sense in which when Rabbi Akiva gets up to say Avinu Malkeinu, a lot is going on. The first thing is that the liturgy of Avinu Malkeinu is direct and has something that is more penetrating than the standard rules, right? The standard Amida. And the fact that he's a student of the teacher sort of even highlights that. But it's more than that. It's also that the character of the person who's leading the prayers matters. When you find out who's going to lead this kahal, this congregation for High Holidays, you got to find the person who embodies certain midot, who embodies rachamim, who is in fact a go-between, because the Baal Tefillah is a go-between, is standing with the tzibor behind him, as it were, and God in front. And this is the person that you want to be as the mediator. Rabbi Akiva is such a mediator. And he's also somebody who in his own behavior actually lets tears flow, lets the water come, as opposed to somebody who is all stopped up and contains things like a plastered cistern. So my thesis here is that the story of the writing of the prayer actually matters to understand the effectiveness of the prayer. And my hope, my prayer, is that when we experience Avinu Malkeinu the next time, we think about the ways in which the writing of Avinu Malkeinu and the people who are saying it are related to the meaning and what's supposed to happen. Thank you.